Okay, I'm Robert Field. I'm at Drexel University here in Philadelphia, where we're used to talking fast and indistinctly, so I'll do my best to keep up our tradition. I'm going to be talking about off-label drug promotion and the efforts of the FDA to regulate it, a little bit of the legal background of court cases that bear on this topic, and then come to my conclusion, which is that efforts to regulate marketing are doomed to fail, that there is just too much at stake with off-label marketing, and I'm going to come up with a few suggestions for how we might get at this issue otherwise, perhaps indirectly, but something that isn't going to be a losing battle every time. I have no financial relationships to disclose here. I will mention some off-label drugs, but not to promote them, certainly. So we have some fundamental policy issues here, and there are arguments, as there are with many of these issues, on both sides. We want to regulate public health in terms of drugs being used appropriately, physicians being knowing what works and what doesn't, what's dangerous and what isn't, versus the concern about free speech, that how far can the government go in telling someone you can't say things or you're criminally liable for saying things. And even if it's misleading or puffery regarding a drug, we do want to be cautious, because if the government can restrict speech in one area, then perhaps it can do so in another area. We have conflicts between safety oversight, the FDA's traditional role, public health's traditional role, and consumer choice. How much do we let individuals make their own decision what kinds of risks they're going to take, as opposed to being paternalistic? We have a contest between regulating information to vet it, to make sure that accurate, truthful information is out there, versus just letting the market of ideas flow and letting people decide for themselves, which is the theory behind the First Amendment. And then diffusion of medical information, which is part of what off-label prescribing is about, and I'll give some examples of ways that it has actually produced innovations and medical advances versus spreading unvetted clinical findings. So by way of background, 1938 Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which still lays the foundation for our regulation of drugs in this country. Drugs are approved by the FDA after a rigorous set of clinical trials, but may only be marketed for specific indications, an indication being a condition, a disease, a symptom that the drug can be prescribed to treat, and it is not legal to specifically promote the drug for something, a condition, whatever, that the FDA hasn't evaluated the data for. If you think that your drug is more usable than what the FDA has approved, you can ask the FDA to approve another indication. That involves getting new clinical data, testing it on other patient samples, and seeing if it works on that condition as well. Indications can be very, very narrow. For instance, an oncology drug can be approved for a specific stage of a specific kind of cancer in a specific kind of patient, only one age group. Most clinicians might know that it works in a much broader subset, but that the FDA has only looked at a narrow set of data, and so can only say definitively that it works for this narrow group. So that's what the FDA can do. Conflict is that physicians are permitted to prescribe any approved drug for any purpose. So even if there is no FDA-approved indication, a physician can decide that it works for something completely unrelated, or something very close, that the drug is approved for stage 2 colon cancer and they're going to use it for stage 3 colon cancer, and they know there's no reason it's not going to work, it's just that the patient pool for the clinical trials didn't include stage 3. The FDA specifically is not supposed to regulate the practice of medicine, and there was a Supreme Court case a few years ago that emphasized that point. So it cannot tell doctors what to do. It can tell the manufacturers what to do, but it cannot tell doctors what to do. However, having said that, the promotion rather is limited to specific indications, and indications are quite narrow. Off-label prescribing is not only common, it is the economic backbone of the industry. or one of the economic backbones. Best estimates I could find are that 21% of all prescribing, that's about one out of every five prescriptions, is off-label, is for an indication, a symptom or a condition that the FDA has not formally evaluated. According to one estimate, almost three-quarters of those off-label indications do not have scientific support, or at least not systematic scientific support. And in some fields, like oncology, it's half of all prescribing. Now, oncology, there's a reason, as I mentioned, that it's hard to get cancer patients for a trial, so you have to do the testing on a narrow group. And there, it is often known that a drug will work for a different stage or a different form of cancer. But the fact is that it is off-label prescribing. The FDA has not looked at that data. So a huge portion of drug company profits, market, are at stake, and they're not going to walk away from that. They can't just say, okay, we're going to completely refrain from off-label marketing. And here you can see by a few drug classes, in cardiac, close to half, psychiatric, close to a third, coming out with that total of 21%, and the estimate that three-quarters of it doesn't have actual scientific findings to back it up. Some examples of successes, though. In addition to the incremental differences, as in oncology, we've got minoxidil, otherwise known as Rogaine, for hair loss, which is a blood pressure drug that turned out by happenstance can regrow hair in men who are going bald. Before the data was fully collected, before the FDA had a chance to review the new indication, this was widely known in the medical community. And of course, the more it's used on an experimental basis, the more ammunition there is to do those clinical trials and get the formal indication. Tricyclic antidepressants have been shown to work on neuropathic pain. As I mentioned, oncology drugs for different forms of cancer, and pediatric drugs. Most pediatric drugs are prescribed off-label because the clinical trials don't include kids, so the indication doesn't include children, but the medical community often knows that the drug will work, perhaps at a lower dose, and you don't want to deny the medication to kids. So there are reasons to permit this, valid reasons. How do physicians find out about off-label uses, about minoxidil and oncology drugs and so forth? Well, there are publications, peer-reviewed and otherwise, peer-reviewed ranging from the New England Journal down to journals that are sponsored entirely by drug company advertising and make their money by providing reprints that sales reps can distribute. There are presentations at medical conferences, with and without disclaimers, as we have at our presentations, continuing medical education sessions, physician thought leaders, the top clinician in a field, and then the sales reps from drug companies who go into the physician's office. Drug companies try to use all of those, the last one in particular, and that's where much of the focus of what I'm going to talk about lies. What can they say, and to what extent can the government restrain them from saying certain things? Well, before 1997, before the Food and Drug Administration Modernization Act, the FDA essentially opposed all off-label promotion. If a physician found out about it on their own through reading a journal, through a conference or whatever, that was fine. But there were guidance documents that only permitted the sales reps to distribute reprints from peer-reviewed journals in response to a physician's request. And they would have to document that the reprint that they sent out was reactive to a physician, that they didn't do it on their own initiative. In 1997, Congress passed the FDAMA law, Food and Drug Administration Modernization Act, which addressed this among many other issues. And it specifically permitted distribution of book chapters and articles as long as they were peer-reviewed. The company could not produce the materials itself. They could not make it look glossy, fix up the formatting. But if it was a reprint from a legitimate journal, that was okay. They could sponsor CME programs. They couldn't run them directly, but they could help to fund them. The caveats were that the articles had to go through bona fide peer review, that there had to be a disclaimer saying that the drug's indication had not yet been approved by the FDA. The reprints had to be provided to the FDA 60 days before they were going to be used, so they would have a chance to object. And the company had to intend to file a new drug application for that new indication. And that's very important because that really is the overriding policy goal here, at least I think, is to get the data in the hands of the FDA so the information can be vetted by an impartial organization. So the pharmaceutical industry didn't sue directly to stop these regulations. They went through an organization called the Washington Legal Foundation, which used the First Amendment argument that this was restraining free speech. And before the D.C. Circuit, the District Court for Washington, D.C., they won a major victory. The court said that the guidance documents are unconstitutional, that the FDA can do some things. It can limit sales reps to distributing peer-reviewed articles only, but that it cannot require the prior submission to the FDA or the filing of a new drug application for the new indication. And essentially their analysis was that the First Amendment is at stake here, that speech can be restricted only if it's specifically false or misleading. And this is a gray area as to whether these off-label indications are false and misleading, that there's got to be a legitimate government interest in getting involved in the first place, providing incentives for manufacturers to file the new NDAs is a legitimate government incentive. What they felt was not, and this is kind of controversial, is vetting the information the physicians receive. The court felt that, well, physicians go through all these years of training. Certainly they must know what's legitimate information and what isn't. Something we can debate. And finally, that the restrictions went beyond what was necessary to protect the government interest, and therefore the First Amendment was infringed. And then the next year, in a follow-up case, the same court extended this reasoning to all of FDAMA and said that all of these restrictions are basically unconstitutional, which left the field in a state of tremendous uncertainty. What the FDA did was it came in and issued what are called safe harbors, a set of regulations as to what companies can and can't do. Essentially, they followed the FDAMA rules. But what they said was, if you are within the FDAMA rules, you are safe. We can't come after you. If you're not within the FDAMA rules, it doesn't mean you've broken the law. Those FDAMA rules are unconstitutional, after all. But it means you better be careful. You're not immunized from prosecution, and we're going to look at what you're doing very carefully. And basically, the companies decided to abide by the safe harbor, basically to abide by the FDAMA rules, even though they weren't legally valid in and of themselves, which led to a lot of ambiguity. Recently, in 2006, FDAMA expired. It was basically in place for 10 years. And so earlier this year, the FDA produced new guidance. And the new guidance is overall less stringent. It does not say that you have to file for approval for the new indication. It does not say that the FDA has to approve the materials in advance. But it's also not an explicit safe harbor. It doesn't say that if you follow our rules, you're completely safe from prosecution. It adds two new restrictions, which were not there before, that you have to clearly disclose on the reprints that this new use of the drug has not been reviewed and approved, and you have to provide contravening information. So if you have an article saying that drug is safe and effective for some new use, and there's other data out there saying it's either not safe or not effective, you have to provide that other information to the doctor, you as the sales rep. We have seen both before and after FDAMA expired some vigorous enforcement, so there's a lot going on here. Neurontin in 2004, $430 million fine against Pfizer. Most of these involve uses for which there is no scientific support, and most of them also involve the addition of kickbacks alleged against physicians for prescribing. Xyrem in 2007, a psychiatrist was arrested for accepting $100,000 from Jazz Pharmaceuticals for promoting off-label uses. That is a clear violation of the kickback statute and other laws. A $20 million penalty is less than dollar amount, but it was a criminal proceeding. So you could actually go to jail here instead of just paying money. This year, Zyprexa, earlier this year, $1.42 billion got a lot of people's attention against Eli Lilly, including about half of that as a criminal fine, which no one went to jail, but it's a major statement about how far wrong they went. But look here, sales of the drug in 2007 were $1.7 billion, so we're already more than the fine. And since the drug's inception, $37 billion. So this is really a drop in the bucket, and it's almost a slap in the wrist. So how are you going to use this as real enforcement? Zyvox, again this year, $2.3 billion against Pfizer. You know, we're getting to talk about real money. Again, half of that is a criminal fine. Sales of $250 million in 2008, not on the same level as the others, but a substantial amount of money, and the case involved some other drugs as well that they were promoting off-label. This was the fourth settlement against Pfizer in 10 years for off-label transgressions. And then just last month, Seroquel against AstraZeneca, they agreed to pay about $500 million to settle two federal investigations. An antipsychotic drug, a powerful drug used for other conditions, but since it came on the market 5 years ago, $17 billion in sales. So again, what's the calculus here? It's pretty obvious. So again, what are we dealing with? We don't want to. We couldn't and we wouldn't want to prevent off-label uses. It really does help medicine to advance. We want doctors to know what their colleagues are doing and what new uses of drugs are. However, we know from the enforcement that lack of oversight leads to overly aggressive promotion of unproven uses. We have some logistical problems. Clinical trials are slow, so if a drug company wants to get that approval, they have to wait often years between the time that they do the trials and the time the FDA reviews them. Patents are 20 years from the date of filing. By the time the drug gets on the market, companies generally have about 10 or 15 years of that left. Each year that goes by, they have less incentive to get approval for another use because the drug will be generic and they're just helping a generic competitor at that point. So we have here this perverse set of incentives where actually the easiest route of the company is to do the clinical trials for the narrowest indication. So they're the easiest to do. You have a homogeneous group of subjects. You can get the least number of subjects. Once it's on the market, a doctor can prescribe it for anything. So then you can try to get your sales reps to come in under the radar and tell the doctor, oh yeah, it was only approved for this narrow use, but it, you know, cures what ails you and use it for everything else. So drug companies will always face incentives, at least under our present structure, for off-label prescribing. It is too profitable to stop, as we've seen. The sales dwarf the settlement amounts. As I also said, we don't really want to stop all of it. It's the truthful promotion that we want to promote. The regulatory limits are very difficult to enforce, as we've seen, or we wouldn't have these enforcement actions. Prosecution is expensive, it's lengthy, it's also indirect. The ultimate goal is really, let's get as much of the information as we can before the FDA so it can say what really works and what doesn't. So my idea is, why don't we play around with the liability end of this? That if the company is out there promoting a drug for a use, let's say it's subject to a higher standard of care. That if your drug is approved by the FDA, the safety and efficacy have been evaluated, then that's one standard of care. If you're going to go out on a limb before it's been the data has been submitted, you should be held to a much stricter standard for anything that goes wrong. And in effect, we have private enforcement now because we've enabled class actions and private lawsuits. What is a doctor to do in the meantime? What are they to believe? How much off-label prescribing should they do? Well, we can turn to some of the professional societies and some of the impartial government, quasi-governmental organizations that are in the business of guideline and standard setting, to ask them to say, what should a doctor do? What kind of data is legitimate to go on? What should you trust from a sales rep? And to work with the guideline process, which I think would help from that side. And then this could work in tandem with the greater liability for promoting off-label uses. And then this is all in the context of broader FDA reform. As I said, in the present system, you're always going to have these incentives for off-label promotion, off-label uses. The FDA, if it wants to get aggressive, should be using databases to see how much off-label prescribing there is now that they do have access to some of these large managed care national databases. There should be faster review of new drug applications so that when we tell a company, we want you to submit this to the FDA, they can get fast action. It doesn't just sit there for a couple of years. And of course, more resources are needed to do all of this. We'll see if that happens. Thank you.